People don't resist change. I would argue that what people resist is, you know, unsustainable change, change for the sake of change, change without explanation. We're continuous improvement. If we're not willing to take feedback from ourselves, how are we telling everybody else they need to do? We don't care about creating learning outcomes just to have a pretty graph and say we have learning outcomes. It's all about culture.
Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If this is your first time listening in, welcome. We're so happy to have you join us. Our mission here is simple, to improve companies and improve careers through continuous improvement. We're here to share inspiring and interesting stories from individuals who have embarked on the path of continuous improvement. Through these interviews with leaders, innovators, change makers, we explore the sparks that ignite transformative journeys both within organizations and in personal and career growth. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your improvement efforts to the next level, this podcast is here to help guide, inspire, and empower you. I am Keith Norris. I'm your host, and our guest today is Will Miller. Dr. Will Miller is the Associate Vice President for Continuous Improvement and Institutional Performance at SACSCOC, liaison at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He oversees assessment, institutional effectiveness, and all disciplinary accreditations. He developed innovation at Altitude Strategic Plan, founded the Continuous Improvement Summit, and launched the CISS framework for SACSCOC reviews. He also founded the Southern Higher Ed Accreditation Review Committee. He's a leader in the field. He holds multiple leadership roles and publishes in key journals and frequently at major conferences. So welcome, Will. We're so happy to have you here.
It's awesome to be here, Keith. I'm excited to be here and to delve into these topics.
Wonderful. Where are you at today geographically?
Yeah, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
Our main campus is about 45 minutes south of where I am, an hour. And today I just happen to be working from home. So we'll talk a lot about my answers. My team's part remote, part on ground. So we balance a lot of different pieces.
Very cool. Well, I love to get a chance to talk to someone working in higher ed. I know that this thing we call continuous improvement goes by a lot of different names. And one of those names, lean, sometimes gets pigeonholed into like manufacturing. But one of the things I love about these conversations is how the concepts apply to so many different disciplines in so many different areas. So one of the first questions we like to start with, we call this the spark, but was there a moment or a time where you had your first indication that this thing called continuous improvement was maybe a career path that you might find yourself on? Is that a moment that you remember? Tell us how you got your start.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a moment I remember well, and it wasn't my choice. It wasn't my spark in some ways. I was at another institution in Northeast Florida, another private college. And, you know, assessment and accreditation is more familiar to the higher ed world than the idea of continuous improvement. At Embry-Riddle, we're really trying to shift that. But for my start, it was getting thrusted out of a faculty role. I'm a political scientist. We had an immediate need for someone to step in and kind of start leading assessment and accreditation efforts at this institution. And with that work, we're talking about helping faculty measure student learning and what they're doing in the classroom and how it goes up to a programmatic level and how we determine if what we're teaching is having the career impacts and the career placements that we really want and showing that and demonstrating that. And as soon as I got into that role, I'm like, this just feels bureaucratic right now. So at that particular institution, it was really my dive in, and it started with a staff member leaving and them looking around the room and deciding the poli sci guy was the one who was ready to take the baton. And I was ready, and I can't lie, Keith, with what's going on in the world today, I'm happy to not be teaching political science to college students anymore.
Yeah, there's a lot of landmines in the
just a few
right now, isn't there? What are the parts of this continuous improvement discipline that you find most relate to the work that you're doing in higher education?
I mean, so much of it is helping people identify roadblocks and work their way through them, and they change from day to day. And, you know, I'm incredibly lucky. I work at an amazing institution at Embry-Riddle. We're forward thinking, we're innovative, we focus on aviation and aerospace. We always have new things. So I work with people who want to do better. And in the higher ed space, what makes the continuous improvement work so meaningful is you have different contexts all around even, you know, our campuses. At Embry-Riddle, we have, you know, three campuses. We have two residential campuses, and then we have 130 sites across 28 states and eight countries. People are in different places. I have places where, you know, the continuous improvement work's about polishing. We're already where we want to be, and we just want to figure out how to make those incremental steps to get better. And I have others that will say, you know, we're starting off in this, and we have big gains to make. So we're almost building so we can get to the point of polishing. So, you know, we spend a lot of time in my role, things like journey mapping, being able to sit there and think about how does a student progress from, you know, first hearing about Embry-Riddle to hopefully graduating and getting a job, or it could be looking at processes and figuring out where are the sticking points and how do we work around this and how do we ensure optimal opportunities for our students to do well, which is the true measure of whether we're doing well institutionally.
That's so interesting. As you talk about accreditation, I can't help but think, I find a lot of the work in continuous improvement is this tension that exists in this space between, on one hand, you would say like standardization, right? Like we have a standard, we want that standard to be followed. Accreditation is very much about making sure that we meet this standard, right? So it's about keeping things the same. And then you have this other tension in continuous improvement, which is kind of counter. It's like, well, how can you make improvement if you don't try something different, right? So I find it's one of those like areas where you have this tension, and the right amount of one tension versus another varies a lot based on organization or entity, or you might even say culture. In some of the research that we did, I've seen that you have some conversations about connection culture. Share with us some thoughts about culture or connection culture in general. Yeah. And how culture is a part of it.
And it's so funny, Keith, that you mentioned this because, you know, next week, it'll be over by the time this airs and folks are listening, but we're bringing finalists down for an accreditation associate director position. And one of our interview questions we went through in phone interviews was exactly what you talked about. How do we innovate while making sure that we still meet those minimum standards and expectations? Because our accreditation bodies have not kept up. I mean, they all mention continuous improvement, but for continuous improvement professionals and people who really want to see it used to progress, they're not talking the same language or the same expectations. Culture is everything about this. When I took the job at Embry-Riddle a little over 2 years ago, my title was AVP for Assessment and Accreditation, or it might have been Accreditation and Assessment. I forget the order. And within 6 months, we got a new provost who's incredibly innovative and forward-thinking. And I was like, nobody wants to talk to the assessment and the accreditation guy. This is bureaucracy. This is meeting standards. And I'm working with faculty and staff who are so far beyond that type of work, where they're just innovative and they're thinking in directions that, you know, the minimum standards cannot possibly address. And they're rightly bored by the things I'm asking them to do. So we've got to reinvigorate this. So we made it about continuous improvement because that's what we care about. We care about what are we doing. We don't care about collecting data for the sake of collecting data. We don't care about creating learning outcomes just to have a pretty graph and say we have learning outcomes. It's all about culture. And I think a lot of my staff's role on my team and our team and everybody that works on this at Riddle, our job's to make it so that that tension isn't felt by faculty and staff. I want them to dream big. I want them to go do the things they think will improve and help. And then our group can sit there and handle the bureaucratic piece. We can make sure we're doing what the accreditor wants and we can translate it back and we're not, you know, stepping out of bounds. We want to, you know, compliance is key and important. But they shouldn't be worried about, you know, I want to do this really cool new program, but I'm worried that, you know, SAC COC might not like it. You do the new program, I'll handle the paperwork. Like, we can figure that out. You guys are with the students and dreaming this up. Let us help empower that and drive it. And that doesn't happen without conversations and building that trust and knowing what people are passionate about.
I find that this idea, I use the label continuous improvement to refer to everything from lean to operational excellence, even agile and strategic planning, you know, all sorts of different things. And I know sometimes some people would say that lean is a religion or it's a program. And, you know, there's a lot of things that people get right or people get wrong. But I think at some level, the idea that continuous improvement needs to be a core value in an organization, and I see you nodding your head. So I'm wondering if continuous improvement is actually a core value at Embry-Riddle, or if there's a different word that's used there.
Yeah, and it's not a core value today. I'd argue it should be, obviously. But for us, it really falls into the innovation piece. We're not satisfied. We're never satisfied. We meet goals and then we raise the bar on the goal to make sure that we keep moving forward. So I think it falls into the way that we envision innovation. And the only way we can innovate is to just continually keep pushing to get better. It's the first institution I've ever worked at in higher education and the first I've worked with where, you know, they're not happy with minimum benchmarks, even on some of the more bureaucratic stuff. You know, they tell me they want 80% of students to meet an outcome in a particular program. They have 82 and they're like, we could do better than that. Like, we might keep the benchmark there so we feel safe, but man, we're not, you know, we're not going away happy because we're at 82. We want to know what's going on with that other 18. You know, are there reasons? Are there things we can fix? Are there things we can address? And you're right. I mean, people think lean's a religion, all of these different frameworks, different change management frameworks. One thing about working in higher ed that I think is unique from corporate manufacturing, those areas, I'm not going to be successful if I come in and say, we're going to follow lean principles across the board. I'm going to have pushback. I'm going to have, you know, I'm working with hundreds and hundreds of faculty and thousands of staff. It's about figuring out what type of language and model is going to work for them at that time in delivering something that feels tailored to the type of work they're doing and how they're doing it, and getting that buy-in. So, you know, you have folks that, you know, we talk about lean principles with that would never know they're being talked to about lean. We keep the language out of it, or we use the parts that we need. And we have folks that, you know, we're not even necessarily using established frameworks. We're just kind of trying to get them into gear and seeing like, what's something you can do better? I mean, we have open conversations with faculty and staff sometimes where it's like, what's something cool you did last year that we didn't know about that had some type of positive impact? Awesome. Let's see what the impact is now. Where else do we, since we see everybody, think that that type of process or product or whatever they're putting out could be applied and have an equal impact? So much of our job is really being that bridge between departments and programs and faculty who, between their day job and all the extra they do for our students, they don't necessarily have time to then reach across the aisle and be like, hey, I'm doing this really cool thing. Somebody else might want to know. We try to deliver it.
Yeah, I think that you might say like celebrating the wins or sharing the good things that are happening. I know that in a lot of the we work with a lot of companies, big and small, a lot of big companies. One of the biggest challenges in big organizations is, you know, you have these pockets where really cool things are happening and you have like, you know, maybe some leader who's really amazing and they're doing some really innovative things or improvement-oriented things. But then over here, you've got somebody who's struggling and doesn't even know what's possible. And so I think that what you just talked about there is really interesting. Like, there's a real job to be done, a function of sharing that wisdom, that knowledge, those learnings, those wins, depending on how you refer to it. And it sounds like you might have some questions that you use to extract those.
Yeah.
Do you have some questions that you use to extract those? 100%,
and it's all conversation. I'll start with one of the questions we ask people as part of our annual efforts is we basically ask, you know, do you have capacity, and whether that's you as an individual or your office or area, to think about big change this year? And people are honest. There's years where it's like, no, this is a year that because of, you know, disciplinary accreditors are coming in, or we have, you know, changes to something that are happening, or new courses, or a bunch of new faculty. So we're not ready for massive change. This year, it's going to be more incremental, continuous improvement. And then there's years where they're like, this is actually a pretty, you know, stress-free year comparatively. Let's try something new and big. So we start by just asking, where are you on your willingness and ability in this next cycle to really start thinking more long-term? But then when we get into the conversations with everybody, it's kind of what I was saying, where it's, you know, for faculty and academic programs, it's, you know, what did you want your students to learn? How did you tell if they learned it or not? What's working and not working? What do you need to be supported to feel better? It's getting into the rationale behind it. And then with the staff, it's very much, you know, what's something cool you did? What's something you tried? What's something in your office you set up for? And obviously the advent of AI has helped us.
Yeah.
You know, historically, this would all be them sitting down and like filling out templates, and we'd have all this information laid out, and then we'd have, you know, 700 reports, and we'd be like, oh, this is cool. This is cool. With AI, what we do now is we do what you and I are doing right now. We call them up and we talk for an hour. And then at the end of the hour, we have an AI agent that strips the transcript and fills out their template form. So we just talk about like, what are the barriers, and it does that. And then they can back check it and make sure, you know, this is what it's showing. So we're launching that this fall as kind of a way to make this even more impactful and more opportunities for us to consult and help and figure out what's really going on. Because like anybody, and I don't blame faculty or staff at all, I'll talk to you for an hour about this. If you sent me these questions and asked me to write answers, you'd get like two or three sentences to each, because it's just a different dynamic having a conversation with somebody and getting follow-ups and getting to what we need versus sitting there by myself being like, oh, how do I do this? I do this and this and this. Like, just a totally different culture form.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very interesting. You touched on a couple of things that I want to drill into. One of them, I find that metrics, sometimes people call them KPIs, some people call them, I mean, we use the term metrics around KPI Fireland. I'm curious, I would imagine in your role that you probably have some metrics that are like really great. You're happy that they're there. And then you probably have some that feel like they're maybe burdensome. They're like, I don't know why we track this. This is really silly. Are there any that come to mind that you've either found are really great? Because I find sometimes these metrics can give insights across industries as well. What are some of the metrics that you run into?
And I'll say, for me, our most meaningful metric is one that it's our toughest metrics. And that's because we let our academic programs kind of tell us what success looks like, especially with what we do. I mean, at the end of the day, we specialize in aviation, aerospace, engineering. If somebody's just not going to be a good pilot, I think most people would agree they don't want them to meet the outcome and become a pilot. And so we have faculty saying things like, we want 90% of students to achieve this at this level. And what makes it hard is I give them full go. Like, faculty work with their students. They know what success looks like. For you in one program, it might be 90%. For somebody else, it might be 70%. But it all makes sense. Now, in our larger institutional metrics, obviously student success metrics dictate for us. We care about students retaining and coming back and being successful. We care about graduation rates. We want them to get out with a degree. If they're investing money in us, we want that investment to lead to something. But I'd say in a lot of cases, most importantly, we care about what they do with their careers. Do they get jobs they want? Do they earn salaries they want? Do they earn salaries that reflect what they've put into their educational experience? And, on the employee side, we care about retention. We care about internal promotions. We care about professional development. We care about the continuous improvement piece. Even for the individuals, is they're working their way up. And then obviously we care about reputational factors. We do this for our students, and we want to keep getting students. We want to keep giving them opportunities. And we do that through, who we are and what we represent. Most importantly, compared to any higher ed institution I've ever worked with, we are the most mission-driven I've ever been around. If it doesn't touch on aviation, aerospace, or engineering, it's not our business. And that's a reality to it is, you can come in and say, do you want to create a law school, or can we do a law school? Sure, a law school can be super profitable. If we're going to specialize in aerospace, aviation type law, sure, but that's probably not enough to build that type of facility. So from a metric angle, we spend a lot of internal time figuring out how to best put metrics onto, are we staying true to mission? Are we staying on that path? Are we staying ahead of where industry is? Which again, relies on a lot of their metrics too.
That's interesting because one of the things I like about this podcast is we get to take and drill into certain industries or certain examples. And what I always find is, the core concepts of lean or continuous improvement, like you can learn them reasonably fast, but there's so many layers, to this. So I heard you getting into things like what I might call voice of customer, right? Like, you guys have multiple different stakeholders that you need to consider perspectives on. You've got the person coming to you for an education. You've got, like, you want them to have probably 100% good experience, but then you also have like companies that are going to hire people that come out of your facility. And I think you mentioned like reputation, and they have certain criteria. You have the broader public who nobody wants to get in an airplane with an unqualified pilot, right? So I think just, sometimes lean gets simplified into, it's just this straightforward value stream and you just have to optimize around one thing. And so many of us, when we're faced with it, it gets much more complicated. I think that's your scenario.
And it's dials and levers, Keith. That's the problem. Like, what I need to do to get students 100% satisfied is going to upset another group. Our Arizona campus is in Prescott, Arizona. Students want to fly as much as they can. One way to help them fly as much as they can, we can sit there and expand hours that we operate. We can fly them out to more remote airports or smaller airports and have them do touch and goes for hours and get their time in. You know who doesn't like that? The people who live around the small airport that hear our planes all day up and down. Students are more satisfied, but then we hear, concerns from folks that are like, man, why are you guys flying so much at 8 a.m.? It's like, you live by an airport and occasionally you're going to hear planes. And you're not even, with your list, you're right. But it's also, it's parents, it's faculty, it's staff, it's alums, it's broader communities. I mean, for us especially, We obviously, with Daytona Beach and Prescott being our two biggest residential campuses, we want those communities around us to support and enjoy Embry-Riddle being there. But with the 130-some sites, you know, they're all taking up space in different locations. We want those partners to be happy. We have about 400 students in Singapore at a campus now that continues to grow. We want that government to be happy. We're one of only two institutions of higher ed that are not Singaporean-based that they've accredited to operate. And it's us, and then it's John Cook from Maritime out of Australia. We don't want them upset, but what we need to do for them might cost us, you know, from a voice of the customer perspective, points with staff because they have to do a bunch of extra bureaucratic work to make sure the government's happy. But if we don't do that, they're going to be upset. So it's so much on the levers and dials and trying to think through, if I do this to help this group, where am I losing capital with other groups? And what can I afford to do right now? And what can I do to make that up? You know, I spend a lot of my day thinking about, you know, where is my political capital, you know, kind of cup? How full is it with different even individuals? And if it's lower than I need it to be, what can I do? What can I reach out? What can I help with that helps to restore that so that later on, if I need something, I can go and ask and not worry about, I'm starting from zero, which means this is going to be a incredibly uncomfortable conversation instead of an opportunity for me to just be transparent and be like, hey, you're not going to like this one, but we got to do it and I'll help you do it. But I hope I've got enough good grace from you that we can make it work this time instead of feeling like I'm always asking for more and giving nothing.
I think of like the strategic decisions as the decisions that leaders need to make about which stakeholders to put first, second, third, what levels do we want to achieve there. I can only imagine, you know, politically, I'm hearing a lot of stuff with, you know, education. I don't know where you guys land in that. We don't necessarily need to go there. But I also know that being in aviation a few years ago, like I think, you know, this is probably going back 7 or 8 or 10 years now, but drones first came onto the scene, right? And I thought drones were just like toys, just like little RC cars. And all of a sudden I found out that you've got to have like a license with the FAA to operate a drone. So I'm assuming that that's probably an area where there's a lot of interesting innovation happening in your world.
There is. And that's the thing is, it's always about pushing the needle and pushing further. I was with you, Keith, and I tell all of the faculty at Riddle this, like, I'm not an aviation person. I don't know how planes work. I still doesn't make sense to me. They explain it to me all the time. They give me kids books. Like, I get the basic physics, but like, I'm just in awe at all times in these conversations. Drones especially, because I was like you. My background with drones was I'd worked on a couple of projects with the State Department figuring out public opinion toward the use of drones in places like Pakistan and some others. But I never really thought about like what they are and what they do until I got here. But you're right, it's senior leadership. And we're incredibly blessed at Riddle. Number one, we have an incredibly involved, incredibly talented board of trustees. They come from aviation, engineering, aerospace fields. They know the future of their markets. They share that with us. They let us know directions they think we need to go in. And then our core leadership team, we have a very stable core leadership team that again pushes us to stay true to mission. They're fiscally aware. We don't just spend money to spend money. You know, everything that we ask for, the two things we think about are, does this tie to the strategic plan in any way, shape, or form? And will this benefit student success? And if the answer to those two questions are no, that's an uphill battle to climb. Like, you're gonna have to really start making a case. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we have issues that come up out of nowhere that aren't the typical higher ed issues that we have to work with and work around. I mean, drones is a great example. You know, we have our Prescott students. We have a female lead. She hasn't graduated yet and has signed a very nice contract with her first employer. And she has a rocket, I'm gonna call it a rocket club, and that's not the right term, but that's the best I have. But they're sitting there and going out into the Arizona desert and launching rockets 40, 50,000 feet into the sky.
Wow.
And she has one she's working on for this summer that can get to 100,000, which would blast every record for collegiate-based, just amateur building these amazing rockets. I mean, again, I don't understand the math and science behind it, but we have to think about things like, we need to make sure we're cleared to launch a rocket up 100,000 feet on this particular day, and we're not going to accidentally go causing air problems.
Not going to trigger a news story from some.
We want to trigger a positive news story, not a oh no. But we also, and I'll say, I think it's important, Keith, because we look at this from all sides. We also know things go wrong in aviation and aerospace. We have the Boeing Safety Center on campus. Our director there is Robert Sumwalt. He was chair of the NTSB. He knows this inside and out. And Robert has taught me, without knowing it, probably more about aviation than anybody, because from his NTSB time, his LinkedIn is just full of, you know, talking about things that have gone wrong in the past that he's seen or experienced, and safety measures and how we change and make things better. Because, you know, every time something goes wrong in aviation, we're immediately sitting there figuring out what went wrong and what can we do to help students be prepared. And that's so key, is that there's recognition of there's so much innovation that can happen, but there are those things we just need to make sure we know and keep in mind.
What are some of the companies that might look to hire some of the graduates from your programs?
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, you know, obviously we have an air traffic control program on both campuses, and a lot of our students go straight into the ATC, so they're working for the federal government. And from an engineering perspective, you have Boeing, Raytheon, the big engineering firms. And for the pilots, I mean, it's open season. You know, you have some pilots that will go to the Caribbean at first and get their hours and do kind of island hops. You have others that go into the regionals right out. You have others that go in and become charters just to kind of build their hours and get seat time so they can get the jobs they want. But, you know, I think most of them, their goals are either getting into, you know, commercial airlines, whether that's cargo or passenger air. You know, that's obviously our big hope, is that part of it's where do students want to end up? We have to add that too, where it's, you know, the reality is we have some students that their goal is, I want to fly for somebody like UPS or DHL, and I want to fly long distance. So give me like Dallas to Sydney and I'll fly twice a week. And since I'm doing cargo, I don't have to worry about passengers and delays. And if I want to go up, I don't have to worry if it's going to be a little bumpy, if the plane's safe. You have others where the dream's been since they were a kid that, you know, they want to be Sully. They want to be the commercial air pilot. They want to be flying people and having that opportunity. So we try to figure out where they are and what they want to do and then go from there. And that's the aviation side. I mean, we also have aviation business. Mm-hmm. So you start getting into, you know, the business around aviation, the idea of leasing planes and how do we figure out, you know, what residual values are and lease terms and buybacks and intercells and airport management, airline management, whole different side of how do we actually operate these things. We have a program on our worldwide campus that focuses on implementation of baggage systems. How do we design and make baggage systems more efficient and more effective? So lots of opportunities.
That's interesting. I'll tell you, Salt Lake City, the international airport closest to where I live, brand new airport within the last couple of years. And I'll tell you, they have a new Kanban process as you go through the airport security that's really incredible. You know, the little bins they pop up and then they just go through this little conveyor belt. And it's one of those things where I go through that and I see, oh, you know, this is a great implementation of Kanban and queuing and just so many of these skills. I remember traveling through the airport with a friend of mine who was a Lean Six Sigma consultant and was looking at just the queuing process that the airport was using. And it's just, there's so many lessons that's in this methodology that sometimes it shows up in the way people organize their break room, their garage, their sock drawer. Sometimes it's, you know.
I can tell you, I mean, there's no touch point in an airport that we don't have programs that could touch. I mean, if you go, you know, we have Homeland Security and Intelligence. We have folks with TSA. You mentioned the Kanban piece. I mean, we also have up to the doctoral level in human factors. So while we have pilots learning how to fly the plane, we have folks that are figuring out where do we optimally put things in the cockpit to minimize the opportunities for error and delays. So like we're looking at like, where do the buttons go? Which buttons do we need? How do we build this? So I mean, it's the thought process, it's the design. But from the second you walk into an airport or pull up to an airport to the second you land, there's a very high potential that an Embry-Riddle grad is impacting your journey in some way, shape, or form. I mean, the odds of doing, you know, let's say you're doing two flights, like say it has a layover, the odds of not having a Riddle pilot or a Riddle air traffic controller somehow involved is probably less than, you know, 30%. Like you have a great chance of interacting, even though you might not know it.
Well, I do find it really interesting and intriguing. I've used airplane cockpits, you know, pictures of the airplane cockpits as good and bad examples of visual management, you know, and also the idea, like if you don't know what you're looking at, you don't know what to do with the information. And also I think as you move around airports, there's so many good examples of visual management in the way that the planes are managed, et cetera. So it's just, again, it's just that reoccurring lesson that there's so many different disciplines. For some people that are in a career in one area, this skill that we call continuous improvement. You might have learned it in a shop as a line operator, but it can transfer so well because we're talking about processes and even visual management. You know, I'm primarily in the software space, and you know, so much of what we do has an element of the visual management in it. So I find it super interesting.
Yeah.
One thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned that you've got some leadership programs. I'm sure that culture and, like, you know, leadership is a key part of what you guys would teach there. I don't know if this is a fair question, but I would imagine that you guys have done some case studies on culture. You know, for many years, I know, like, for example, Southwest Airlines was often referred to as an example of great culture or a certain strategy. More recently, you've got things like Boeing and problems with culture. I don't want you to throw anybody under the bus that you're not comfortable with, but I'm curious if there's any lessons or examples of case studies that refer back to this idea of culture.
Yeah, and that you're absolutely right. I mean, we have partnerships with all of these groups, so I'm not. There's nobody to throw under the bus because, I mean, this stuff happens. I mean, we all know that, you know, culture is good some places, it's bad some places, it ebbs and flows over time. From the case study angle, though, yeah, it's all about culture. And I mean, you can look at how culture plays impact on the aviation, the engineering side all over the place. I mean, you look at culture, 1980s, one of the big more recent plane crashes came down to understanding of culture. You had a co-pilot, due to cultural differences, who was uncomfortable telling a captain that he was making an error. So instead, he sat and deferred to the captain, and they took the plane into the ground. And it was literally, in the end, part of it was just an unwillingness to challenge because of cultural misunderstandings in that case. So culture we see in all places. And it, as you mentioned, with like the idea of just being in an airport and thinking about the processes at play, the systems at play, the larger system. I mean, so many separate cultures to also consider and think through. So yeah, whether it's Boeing, whether it's some of the new airlines, you know, we obviously have business students that are looking at, you know, what's the idea of value, the value airlines, are they going to make it? Are the Breezes and the Avellos really alternatives to the Americans and the Deltas? Where do the JetBlues fit? What impact is Southwest going to have without their free check bags and getting rid of the board by zone instead of actually having assigned seats? All of those pieces end up having a culture aspect, and they're all geared towards continuous improvement. The irony is, and I think it's one of the most interesting parts that I haven't seen a lot at Riddle, but I haven't dug in to see if it's happening, is where some of the disconnect falls sometimes. So like, let's take what's a business decision that's gonna negatively impact culture, and how do we spin it as a positive culture choice? What's something that we're doing not because it's gonna help culture, but because the bottom line says we have to survive, but we also have to try to put some, you know, fancy window dressing on this, so we're not just saying if we don't do this, we're gonna be, you know, in trouble. We need the money, whatever it might look like. But you know, that all plays into it. So those conversations happen. I don't have any great examples of case studies, but all sorts of research that comes out that really dives into it.
Got it. Are there, you know, we think about this toolbox or skills related to continuous improvement. You know, different industries rely more or less on certifications like Green Belt or Black Belt, and, you know, some more on Lean, some more on Six Sigma, some more on visual management. What are some of the tools or skills that you find yourself relying on in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, for us as an institution, obviously we have, you know, engineering's big to us. The engineers love Lean. It makes sense. They're thinking about it from a manufacturing system angle, so I can talk a little more Lean with them directly without people trying to figure out what I'm saying and what I'm doing. A lot of visual management. To be honest, like I said, Keith, part of it in higher ed, and I think this is where we differentiate a little bit. If I was going into a manufacturing company, I could go in and say, this is the model I'm going to use, and I'm going to instill it across the board, and people will typically follow. Like, they, you know, they might not like me, they might not like it, but like, they'll get on board with that. At a higher ed institution, there's so many different things happening, it's harder to ever say we're all doing the same thing at the same time, even. We're all working towards the same goals. And it leads to a lot of, again, as I shared, conversations and kind of thinking through. I find myself relying more on change management pieces. How am I going to pitch this as change management, and the continuous improvement's going to be change management? especially, I mean, even on some of the basics from change management. I mean, some of it's explaining to a faculty member or a new staff member that we're going to, you know, we're going to freeze, make a change, and then unfreeze and start measuring. And that's all they need to kind of get their head around, okay, so there is a point where we unfreeze and this actually happens. A lot of process mapping, a lot of journey mapping. I have somebody on my team, Naima, who is phenomenal at helping people walk through journey maps and pulling out outside influences and where are issues running in. So I am probably a bad example for folks of like going into to one or two tools and really making it work, as opposed to I spend a lot of time figuring out what someone needs and then getting on and trying to learn about a tool very quickly that I can then use to help them. Yeah. Which makes the job really fun, but definitely means every day is a little different and a little challenging.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I really like about this discipline. And one of the things that I'm really trying to make an impact with this podcast is that, yeah, some people are going to be on a path of becoming a master black belt, or, you know, they've got the responsibility to train 100 people in lean or something in their organization. But there's a lot more people who have been exposed to a little bit, and maybe they were exposed to a five whys, or maybe they were asked to draw a picture of what's going on, or maybe they were asked for a root cause analysis, and they didn't even realize that this thing that they were doing that really just seemed like common sense or a task was a piece of a broader set of skills. You know what I mean? It's like if your only exposure to, you know, becoming a pilot was you liked paper airplanes as a kid, you kind of need to have your eyes open to like, wow, there's a school I can go to. This is a career. I could make a living out of this thing. And I think that's one thing that I find with continuous improvement in this discipline and a lot of the people that I talk to. Like there's some people who, and I think that this is a, I think this is something that's intrinsic. It's built into the DNA of humans, is this idea that we need to grow, we need to improve, we need to evolve. I think that's like at the DNA level. And I think that this discipline, when it's applied inside organizations, it has kind of a similar, like it's necessary. It's part of the force that's required to sustain life in an organization. Organizations that don't evolve and don't change and don't grow, they die. You know, if you're not gradually improving, you're getting worse. You're on your way down the other side of the curve.
100%. And that's the thing. If you're not gradually improving, at some point you're going to be faced with the decision to make a ton of change really quickly, which is going to upset everything, culture, function, system, like it destroys all of these things. But I think you're right. At the DNA level, every time somebody kind of resists the continuous improvement piece or what we're thinking about or trying to get folks to do, again, we don't tell them what to do. We try to get them to do something and adopt it. I assume in my head, because it's how I am, that they are actively kind of pushing themselves to resist. Like it's not natural to be like, no, it's like, yeah, this, and I hear it sometimes, like what you're saying makes sense. They'll tell, like I'll have staff tell me like, what you're saying makes perfect sense. Where do I find the time to do it? Is it resourced so I can do it? And I'm like, so you're agreeing with the principle. Now we're discussing how we get to do this, but that's good to know. That's a good conversation. And I think, you know, you mentioned the five whys. I mean, I should have said that to the last question. I use the five whys all the time. I try not to use it as just the five whys because faculty don't like if I keep saying why. But I try to get it into like, let's get into the root of what we're really doing and why we do it. And on that assessment side, it's what we're excited for in the fall, where if I can use that, the conversational piece like this, it's a lot less off-putting top down. If I ask in a podcast, like, why are you approaching it this way? And have you thought about doing it this way? That's way more conversational and inviting than, you know, having a text box that says, please justify everything you said you're doing in the box before this. Like that feels like I'm auditing.
Yeah.
And again, nobody's ever happy to talk to the auditor. Let's be honest. Like nobody's enjoying that conversation, even if it goes well. So I think you're right that the human DNA side is to keep improving. And I mean, that's evolution. Like we know that we have to evolve in some way. And the options are, do we do it over time and take ownership of it and be able to tackle the small questions and dot the I's and cross the T's and know what the positive and negative externalities are going to be from the decisions we make? Or are we going to get to the point where our choices are massive structural change, fire 40% of your workforce, change your mission, or to your words, die? And that's a very different scenario to be in. Like nobody's having fun with either of those options.
Yeah.
And then you look back and you're like, my God, I could have over the last two, three, 4 years been making smaller changes that would have been less impactful that I could have, you know, to my earlier conversation, that I could have kept building back my political capital while I'm doing it, as opposed to now I'm not just draining it, but I have no chance of ever regaining it. In either way, if we make that type of massive change at the last minute, I've lost, you know, my following. And if we die, it doesn't matter if I have political capital.
Yeah. And there's an interesting quote. It goes something like, you know, humans don't necessarily resist change. We just tend to resist being changed, right? Nobody really likes to be told you need to change or you need to do this. But we all, there's an interesting exercise I've done with a group of people that I'll share here is, you know, you ask somebody what, you know, ask a group of people what a good day is. And a good day for a lot of people usually sounds like solving a problem, coming up with a new idea, implementing something, fixing something. You ask them what a bad day is, and it usually sounds like having some major problem, having something they were working on, have the rug yanked out from underneath it. And the interesting thing about that little exercise is that you realize that it's the same things that happen in between a good and a bad day. It just depends on which side of the change you're on. Are you the one with the idea to fix the problem, or are you the one feeling paralyzed by the problem?
1,000%.
Yeah. So I like that you brought up the change management component, because I think, you know, again, part of what we're trying to do here is to shed some light on, it's not just one discipline. It's not just lean engineers that make this thing work. It's not just an HR department that cares about change management and people's feelings. It's not just about strategic planning. It's not just about finance KPIs. Like, there's a discipline that has to blend a lot of this stuff that is a skill set that can really help people advance their careers, as we mentioned in the, yeah, in the mission.
And I do think that's the skill set part. I mean, when you get into the Spark, and, you know, this is kind of the backstory. When I talk to, you know, my wife or my family, especially my mom, about what I do and how I do it, she's never surprised, because she's like, you were the kid in elementary school who was friends with everybody. The kids who didn't like each other, you were friends with both of them still and could make that work. And I won't lie. I mean, I do think some of the political science, my political science background is really in campaign management, polling, elections. It's being able to talk to people and meet them where they are. It's being able to give the same general message, but fine tune it. And that's a lot of what this is. People need to hear different things to get on board, because that quote's amazing. I mean, I absolutely agree with it. Like, people don't resist change. I would argue that what people resist is, you know, unsustainable change, change for the sake of change, change without explanation, change without transparency, change without, you know, how is this going to help me do something better? But if I can sit down with a faculty member and say, hey, we're going to do this and it's going to positively impact your students and you're going to see this, they buy in. Now, when I need them to maybe help me do something where that's not going to happen, we have a very different conversation. I'm like, look, this isn't going to help students. This is going to be a building block that we use to do something else 3 years later. And I'm willing to give everything I can to make this as painless and easy as I can for you, because at that point, otherwise, I'm telling them, change this to change it. And that's not, again, like you said, I think that's the change people resist, is like, we're just changing. So like, if you say it's tech side, since you're on the software side, so say, you know, we switch ERPs and it's been a 3-year process and it's an overhaul and it impacts every process and everybody else. And then at the end of that 3 years, our contract comes up and somebody says, oh, we could save $500,000 if we switch to this other one. So let's do it again. And you're sitting there like, we're just changing to change. We don't have vision. We don't have strategy behind this. We're just, you know, trailing dollars. Or it's no different than mission creep. If you're in higher ed and you're just going to add programs because you think they could add dollars to your revenue and you need the dollars, but they don't fit who you are or what you are, that's a problem. I mean, if Embry-Riddle decided tomorrow they were going to add a musical theater program, that would be strange given the other programming we offer. No different than if a liberal arts college tomorrow decided to cut a musical theater program and add a cybersecurity program. We have to figure out who we are and drive everything around that. And, you know, to your point about we make change or we could die, there are times where you have to rip that bandaid and be like, yeah, look, this time we have to do a lot and we got to do it quick. And it's kind of a reprogramming. But you have to be honest about that stuff. You can't convince people it's good for them. There's things that are going to hurt that we have to do. There's things that might not immediately have the impact and cause, you know, fear or concern or pain. And that's all part of culture. I mean, my own team right now, Keith, we're doing 360 evals for the first time. And we talk about continuous improvement. And I mean, they're on edge. They're like, how are these going to be used? Well, I see what people say, what, you know, what happens. And I'm like, guys, we're continuous improvement. If we're not willing to take feedback from ourselves, how are we telling everybody else they need to do this? Like, we've got to be able to look at this and be like, yeah, here's two or three things I might be able to work on in the hopefully in the immediate that will lead to more positive interactions.
That's a good topic. I'm sure I know that we've had that topic of 360 evals. Whenever you ask questions like that, every question you ask, especially in a company, you know, the culture of the culture of the company, the trust that exists, people are always like triangulating, you know, and another quote that I'm reminded of, you know, tell me how you'll measure me and I'll tell you how I'll behave, right? Like, it's like, depending on how you're going to use the answers is how I'm going to answer the question.
Yep. And that's, but to go back to your point from a minute ago, I think that's also natural human behavior.
Yeah.
Like, we want to evolve, but we don't necessarily want to be evaluated.
Yeah.
And I view it the same way as, like, I don't like going to the doctor and having blood work taken, even if I know I've been doing what I'm doing, because there's just a chance it might not be, and I'm going to hear something I don't want to hear. I don't love evaluations, even if I know they're probably going to be strong and solid and give me helpful things. I think it's just kind of one where, in general, we're like, we don't know. We don't like that uncertainty, which is why it's so important on continuous improvement that we're informing people on what we're doing and why, that we're managing the change. Because if people know, they may not like it, but they can normally at least respect, like, all right, at least I knew this. And I'll give a great example. I mean, my president at my former institution, I was there during COVID. And he wanted you talk about voice of the customer. We were polling students every night on something. We just wanted them in the habit of responding when we had to go remote for higher ed. But he was very good at one thing, and like a return to campus and masks. He had me ask students, like, how do you feel about a mask policy that you have to have a mask on if you're in class? And it came back and it was like 70% of students were just absolutely opposed to having to wear a mask. And then he issued the announcement 2 days later of, I'm putting a mask policy in place. You're all going to have to wear masks. And then he went through and he's like, I heard everybody who was upset. I read every comment. I read every concern. He's like, but at the end of the day, I need to do this to protect the 30% who do.
Yeah.
So there was at least, like, they were mad, but it was like, our voice was heard. He responded to us. He explained how he made the decision. And that resonates. Like, it's like, okay, I can have a better understanding versus if they hadn't been asked and a mask policy had been announced. Now they're upset, they're not involved, they don't know the logic, they're less likely to believe anybody cares about it. It's just all of those things that can be controlled. So we need to control the controllable so that people can feel good about the directions we're going in and share that with them.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of respect. You know, you're respecting someone enough to ask them their opinion. I think that there's certainly an element of good leadership. A good leader can communicate respect, but a good leader can also communicate when, hey, I need to make a decision and this is the decision that I'm making and here's why I'm making that decision. I'm sorry that you don't agree with it. And it's not like, you know, tough cookie, like it's done in a respectful way. And again, this is one of those things where I say, you know, I act like I know the right answers, but as a human being, I always make mistakes with these things too. That's what I love about this discipline is it's easy to know the principles, but it's so hard to, you know, the lessons just keep coming. The lessons are.
Yeah. And people that are in this field get it. I mean, my team will get emails from me every once in a while or Teams messages where I'll have a week where I'm just off. Like, I told you I was going to do something and it's actually going to be next week. And I'll shoot them a message. And I'm like, man, guys, and I have a team of 10. And I'll be like, man, guys, I just blew it this week. And I am sorry if it came out on you or anything. And like, that gets buy-in again. It gets grace. It helps with that political capital where it's, I'm going to acknowledge that this was not an A for me. But because I believe in continuous improvement, that's just an opportunity for the next week to make sure that I'm improving on that and addressing the things that didn't go well for myself.
Well, let me just kind of finish up with what I'll call a quick fire here. These will just be some relatively short questions. Just give me the first, you know, kind of first words or phrase that comes to mind. The number one job of a leader is to
understand. It's about understanding for me.
Understand. That's a great one. Are there some books on this topic in this discipline that you might recommend?
You know, the book I recommend, it's not going to be exactly on continuous improvement, but I'm a big fan from change management of Kotter's work. I know a lot of folks are familiar with John Kotter's stuff, but his 8 steps are the ones that I'm able to most go back to and explain things to folks that are either not on board or not understanding. So I'd point a lot of people towards Kotter, and it's going to be the change management piece. So you're going to have to inject the continuous improvement. Yeah. But if you get lean, you can see where it fits into Kotter.
Okay. How about the one piece of career advice you might give someone listening to this?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's follow what you think you want to do and see if it's really it. I mean, I fell into this by accident. I mean, that Spark question was such a good one, where it was a president and a provost saying, hey, we think you could do this. So if people are saying they think you have a skill set for a job like this, it can go so many directions. I've worked for higher ed tech. I've worked for different universities. And in all honesty, in this field especially, make sure you keep the relationships. This is an opportunity to talk to everybody. If you're on the corporate side and you're in a company or you're in a manufacturing company, this is your reason to get to know every single person within an org structure or an org tree. And not many people have that need outside of HR. But again, with like stuff like HR, it's onboarding, it's offboarding. This is much more like continual helping them through a process. So take advantage of it.
That's great advice. Okay, this last question. If there was one meeting that you could have this week with your team, what would it be? Like, what would be the structure of that meeting?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if I could do one meeting this week and have my team, it would definitely for us be the kind of strategic vision planning that we need to do, which is going to sound like a very kind of cut and dry answer to folks. But, you know, when my team came into Riddle, we've had some pretty big turnover. We've changed a lot of processes. We've changed a lot of systems. We've rebranded and we've done a great job in 2 years. But it's time for us to think about like the next 3 years and where can we really be disruptive? Where can we really change the heart of how things are happening to make it more impactful, more efficient, more effective, better for people where they actually enjoy this work and understand our why behind it? Because that's the fun part, is being able to sit there and see people take this on their own. I mean, my favorite thing is when somebody comes back and they're like, yeah, so this year we took some of the stuff that you told us about Kotter and we've changed these 4 processes in our office without you even knowing. And we're seeing all, so I'm like, great, this is like, we're like spreading the web so that others are taking it on their own and not depending on us for assistance on it.
I think that's fantastic. Yeah, there's certainly like a pay it forward element of this knowledge that is part of this continuous improvement discipline that I find that's another thing that I hear and see a lot of people talking about. And you mentioned a minute ago with the, you know, I think that's something that people with in this discipline have that responsibility too, to find like, hey, who's the next person that could be successful with this skill set, with this knowledge.
100%. And I think that's the thing, Keith, is like, you know, as you said, Lean's one that kind of gives it. We have certifications that kind of get this. You have some PMI folks who I think fall somewhat into continuous improvement, not all the time in all cases. But it's not like there's one thing to look for. It's not like aviation where you need an FAA certification to fly. This can come from anywhere. So it's figuring out who really has that more inherent skill set that likes to talk to people and can help people identify problems without making it feel threatening or concerning. Yeah. And you naturally experience that.
Yeah, I think there's so much problem solving that needs to be done in the world, right? I've never met a company that has too many people that know how to do a good job of solving problems. I've seen plenty of companies with too many problems
and nobody to solve them. That's one of my favorite alumni stories. This was the first institution I worked at that I talked about earlier. When I was at Flagler College, we had a philosophy major who'd placed into a top 4 financial firm. And people were always asking him, you know, how did you get this job? You have no finance background. And he's like, they don't want finance background. I know how to solve problems. And that is how he had banked his career. I mean, he was doing that. He was at a, you know, basically an AVP level 4 years out of undergrad with a philosophy major at a top 4 financial firm, having never taken a finance class. But he can solve problems.
That's the key. And you know what? I think that's, you know, as we talk about all the building blocks of this discipline, structured problem solving and having a problem solving approach that you can follow is certainly one of those. Well,
yeah. And you don't have to be content experts.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly think I'm better at my job where I am today because I don't understand how planes fly or engineering, because I go in, and I don't want to say go in blind, but like, I don't have ideas on the content. You tell me how you're doing this. I have no thoughts. If they were political scientists, I might be like, ooh, well, we could do this, or we could tweak. Like, I don't have any of that. Yeah. So I go in looking at it almost as a blank slate, and they have to explain things to me so I can understand. And that's where I can learn a lot.
Yeah, they call it what they call it, the curse of knowledge, or a beginner's mind. You know, approaching a problem with a beginner's mind, you see things in a different way.
Yeah.
Well, Will, I really appreciate you joining us today. It's been such an interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to just keeping up with you. I have to look you up sometime when I'm in town. It sounds like a very interesting operation that you guys have there. If somebody wants to catch up with you on LinkedIn or find you, how could we find you?
Yeah, so on LinkedIn, it's Will Miller, PhD, I think is my after the slash. But if you find Will Miller, it's a picture. It looks just like I do now for the most part. And then also email. I mean, will.miller@erau.edu. Feel free to reach out. And, you know, anybody interested on the continuous improvement side, I mean, if they're near Daytona, let me know. If they're ever in Daytona, I'm happy to show people around. We have a lot of cool toys we can show. I'm happy to take people if they're in Prescott. I'm just not in Prescott most of the time. So, you know, when I'm out there, I'm happy to show people that. I mean, I'm proud of our students. I'm proud of our campus. I'm proud of all the work we do. So always happy to show that off and share.
Well, it definitely shows. It's so much fun for me to chat with folks like yourself. And I, on behalf of the public, I appreciate what you guys are doing to put good pilots and good operators in and around the air traffic system
100%.
In general.
And again, it's not me. That's everybody else. But I just try to make sure we've done the compliance parts.
Well, you know what? I think that just your energy and your enthusiasm for the work and the fact that, you know, you're not the one flying the plane or whatever, but you feel connected to that mission. I think that is a very good example. And I think that that's something that people listening to this podcast and other organizations, I've talked to people that work as people, let's say, soldering capacitors onto medical equipment who feel connected to the outcomes, the patient outcomes that those products are delivering. And I think those are good examples for us to see what's possible inside other companies and to strive for in our own. And so I really appreciate this conversation. And for anybody that's listening to it, if you have questions for Will, certainly look him up. If you have questions that you want to ask us or other guests that you want to recommend, you can find me on LinkedIn also, Keith C. Norris. This concludes the episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us on the socials and share the podcast with friends or colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change. This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire. KPI Fire is continuous improvement software. KPI Fire helps you align strategy, drive execution, and engage people, all in one powerful software platform. So whether you're leading a team or transforming an entire organization, KPI Fire is your partner in achieving breakthrough results. You can learn more at kpifire.com.